This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
Coming up deep in the heart of Texas, we are going to be able to witness a celestial dance, and that's like the most poetic I can come up with an introduction. But coming up on April 8th, we are going to be kind of right in the middle of the most talked about subject when it comes to things like that, and that is the eclipse. It is going to pass virtually right over our head, and we're going to have an amazing view of it. So I thought it would be fun to talk about the eclipse and various things as far as our Earth and Moon and Sun and stuff like that with someone who's an expert who actually knows this stuff, and that is Keeley Finkelstein, who is an associate professor at the Department of Astronomy, College of Natural Sciences for UT, and she works with the McDonald Observatory. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on this goofy little show that has usually charities and those sorts of things on, and some sort of a public thing that has to do with either a charity or an event. And this is an event, but this is a little bit more than your average event. This is the kind of thing that doesn't come around all that often. And it's pretty amazing when it's going through your backyard and we have one of the best views for it. And so I thought it would be a great opportunity to be able to nerd out a little bit on some things that maybe out there you don't ordinarily think of. You know, people look up at the moon and they look up at the sun and they know that they're there, but maybe you don't know why that they're there. And we could spend 26 minutes talking about the eclipse, but that'd be a lot of telling you not to look at the sun. So I thought it might be a little bit of a more entertaining conversation to talk kind of bigger picture. And so Keeley has kindly joined me to fill in the blanks of what my very limited knowledge is. And so starting with something as simple as what are the differences between the two kinds of eclipses that we have?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in general, when we mean eclipse, we are talking about one object basically kind of casting a shadow out into space, and the other object is passing through it, either being completely kind of covered up or blocked, and in that and the other object's shadow, or partially. And so it worked out. It's kind of like sort of just a nice cosmic coincidence that between the three important objects in terms of the eclipse, we have the sun, Earth, and moon. In our sky, how big both the sun and moon appear, their apparent size are basically the exact same. And so when we get a solar eclipse, that is when we have the sun and then the moon and then the Earth, and all three are lined up in that order. And that occurs during the new moon phase. But not every new moon. Obviously, you just said how kind of rare eclipses and solar eclipses are. So it's only when they are lined up and basically in a perfectly straight line. And so the moon is therefore kind of casting a shadow out into space, and part of the surface of the Earth is being hit by that shadow and therefore eclipsing the sun. When other times when we have a lunar eclipse, it's when the moon is on the opposite side of the Earth in kind of the full moon phase, full moon orientation. So it would be sun, Earth, and then moon, and the moon is passing through Earth's shadow.
Joining me on Inside Austin to discuss the upcoming eclipse on April 8th is an associate professor from the University of Texas and the McDonald Observatory, Keeley Finkelstein. If you would like more information on the eclipse or on the observatory itself, go to mcdonaldobservatory.org. One of those things that we sort of never think about because we don't feel it and it is far beyond what we are able to observe is, you had said things lining up perfectly, and we are... Obviously, the moon is rotating around us. The Earth is spinning, and the Earth is rotating on its own axis, and it's going around the sun. But all of those things are moving in space, too. So we are whipping through space in all sorts of different directions. And so for these things to line up, in addition to the fact that in a, as you said, celestial coincidence, which is a great name for a jam band, for the record, is the size, the fact that our moon is almost the exact same size in the sky as the sun. Our moon is really big for our planet of our size. That's a weird thing for, if you look in the solar system and for what we know about other planets outside of the solar system, our planet has a really big moon, and it's fascinating to know, you know, I've watched Nova and a few things on various channels on cable TV, but I'm not going to pretend like I am the expert. That's, once again, that's why you're on the line. But my understanding and like the leading theory is that a protoplanet during the initial forming of ours billions of years ago smashed into it. And because of that, we have our seasons and we have our moon and we have so many things that are, once again, a kind of a coincidence that would help support the kind of life that we know it. Life probably would have happened here anyway, but it made it the way that we know it. Things would have been different if we didn't have something as... like the tilt that we have, that the theory is, my understanding is that the planet smashing into us tilted us just enough, and that's how we have our seasons. And it's fascinating to think of those things in such, they're abstract, but they're kind of easy to think about at the same time. You know, a planet crashing into another one, you can sort of visualize that, but it is also abstract because of the size and the energy and the severity of it. And that's one of the fun things that you kind of do, is you deal with this abstract realness.
Yeah, it is kind of, you know, you take a step back and think about it. It blows your mind constantly, even for those of us that, you know, think about it on a more regular basis. But yeah, just like you said, like all those things are sort of, you know, sort of amazing that all of that happened. And the actual event, and you're right, the leading theory for how we have the moon, the size the moon is it was a large collision. And early on in the solar system, when kind of all of the planets were in the process of forming and the young Earth, kind of proto-Earth, would have been, you know, pretty close, you know, to get kind of probably current size and getting sort of established. But then you basically have this huge violent collision with something that we think maybe was on the order the size of Mars, you know, comes smashing in and smashes into the very young Earth. And they both kind of, you know, that proto Mars or proto planet probably would have been almost completely sort of destroyed. And a good chunk of the Earth would have been kind of just, you know, blown off, thrown out there. And then they kind of both sort of kind of coalesced, but they would have been basically these just huge molten, you know, balls of burning rock and fire from this violent collision. But yeah, much larger. If we look at the inner solar system and the inner, we call terrestrial rocky planets, Mars is the only other planet in the inner solar system that has moons besides us. And they're these, you know, much smaller kind of oddball shaped moons that are actually probably captured asteroids, not nearly the size of our own moon. And only when you get into the outer solar system and the very large, you know, gas giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, do you find similar sized moons.
And they also, my understanding, once again, on my basic PBS level, is that's also, they think that maybe where our molten core came from was that collision. Yeah. And that makes a huge difference as far as being able to maintain our atmosphere from solar wind and stuff like that. So
giving us kind of both geologic activity and magnetic field kind of protection, all that stuff. Even also then now, when, you know, having that large moon to kind of establish, giving us things like tides, you know, you talked about that. That's also sort of probably helpful to some of the life and how it developed and things like that. So yeah, it's just, it's kind of, again, another one of these sort of cosmic nice coincidences, but again, violent and crazy at the time when it was happening, but as things settle out, it kind of has a lot of these really important benefits and interesting history to learn about.
Well, and that's the history that fascinates me. Like, while I appreciate the history of hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago, the fascinating history to me is the one that doesn't have a narrative, the one that has to be pieced together through evidence and abstract thinking that is rooted in reality again. That sort of your that's kind of what a scientific theory is that you guys aren't arrogant enough to say that you know for sure, but observable and testable evidence leads us to believe that this is the idea. And it's fascinating to think like those sorts of things, that there was a time where we didn't have any idea where our moon came from, and now we have a really good theory that makes all sorts of sense, that kind of checks all the boxes that where things were mysterious about. And you were talking about going out into the gas giants and the ice giants, and how they're so much bigger and they're so much different, and their moons are minuscule. They may be roughly the size of our planet, but once
Yeah,
again, in
comparison.
comparison-wise, they're minuscule. And it is fascinating to think that we've got two different kinds of, or three different kinds of planets, I guess. We've got the rock ones that you can stand on, and then it's once again, not to talk about things that I don't necessarily know a lot about, but sort of I've also heard that the gas giants are they're possibly failed stars. They didn't have the right chemistry. They didn't have the right makeup in order to start the process. So they're just a bunch of weird gases that exist in a bubble, which we can't understand. But that's what gravity and these weird forces that you don't think about on a daily basis have a bigger impact than you dropped your pencil. And I very much appreciate how cool your job is, and how your history is the kind of history that can define what we end up doing as mankind, as opposed to, yeah, it's great someone settled a country or there was a war or something like that. But being able to piece together something that happened billions of years ago, that's pretty cool. I'm envious of your job. I'm just a dopey radio host. Like, you have a cool job.
Yeah, I always tell my students, why study astronomy, right? They think it's, I guess, cool. That's why they take the classes. But I always tell my students it's kind of like the ultimate origin story, right? And as humans, we're always curious. We always want to know, what's my history? Where do I come from? Well, yeah, going back billions of years to the origin of the solar system, that's our, or even beyond that, right? How did our galaxy come together, and how did our galaxy form, right? That's like the ultimate origin story.
Yeah, and then you start to getting into some really big cosmic coincidences, like our distance from the sun and the size of our sun and all of that kind of stuff. And it really is amazing, the ingredients and the little details that if they were just off by the slightest bit, things would be dramatically different. And a big scale example of that is had that asteroid, what was it? It's like the size of Texas or something like that, the one that took out the dinosaurs. Like, if it weren't for that, we wouldn't be the dominant species, and we certainly wouldn't be having this conversation, and there'd still be giant lizards everywhere. And it's just such a weird thing that everything is such a delicate balance to end up where we are, but yet here we are experiencing it and talking about it.
No, it's very, very poetic in some ways to think about it, right? And how we can analyze and study it, and then but how all those things had to come about for us to be having this conversation right now.
Associate Professor Keeley Finkelstein from the Department of Astronomy at the University of Texas is joining me on Inside Austin to discuss the upcoming April 8th eclipse. If you would like more information on the eclipse or what they do, go to mcdonaldobservatory.org. And oddly enough, it's funny you just use the word poetic, because one of the things that I consider to be sort of poetic and really interesting about this whole process is that most people out there listening assume that you're popping your eye into, squinting one eye and sticking your other one in a telescope and just randomly sticking it in the sky. And while you might be doing that for fun in your backyard, you look at data, you look at information. You don't necessarily look at pictures, because that's not what the telescope reading it, radio waves or various other forms of information that can be interpreted and turned into pictures and seen from an expert's point of view. But, you know, you're not looking through a backyard telescope looking at Jupiter or something like that. You are getting a report from an observatory and you are crunching numbers and you are looking at the differences between things. And that is amazing to be able to turn that into something like the origin story of the planet, taking that information, and that is the poetry behind it. It's almost like writing music or something like that. We don't understand the nuts and bolts and the notes that have been written. We're just amazed by the results. And you know, you get to write that song, for lack of a better way to put it.
You make it sound even a lot more poetic than I can. That's great. And that is true, right? The somewhat kind of, you know, idealized view of what an astronomer as a scientist is standing in the dark, just looking through the telescope. But you're correct. Yeah. Most of us, what we're doing, you know, we're collecting data from a variety of telescopes all around the world or out in space and at different wavelengths of light, right? Not just from the visible part of the spectrum. And then, yeah, putting all of those pieces together and writing computer code and programs to analyze the data, and then figuring out the best ways to interpret the data, coming up with models to help us with that interpretation of the data, and testing some of those predictions that we've made in the past, and making sure the data continues to kind of hold up with what our prediction or our model or our theory is, and just kind of keep new questions get raised all the time, and we're kind of continually searching for better improved data and better ways to kind of explain a lot of these different phenomena.
I would assume probably one of the last steps is pointing an actual telescope with lenses and stuff like that at whatever you were, if that's even observable. But I would imagine that that's kind of one of the last steps, is to go to one of those type of telescopes to look at it. You're looking for the information leading up to that. I would imagine the lens telescope, I don't know the different names, so excuse me if I'm obviously, I know that you guys don't call it a lens telescope, but I would imagine that that's sort of the confirmation that the numbers were correct.
Yeah, part of it. And sometimes we get new, most of the telescopes we refer to them like using, they have a large mirror, and they will have, different optics that the light can pass through after it hits the mirror, the surface of the mirror. And sometimes, right, it's like using other older data, right, to make, okay, I need new information. So I have to write a proposal to try and gather, try to get telescope time or data from a different telescope, whether it's a different wavelength or maybe it's a space telescope that can give us a little more, better resolution or better, slightly higher quality data. So it's kind of this, continual thing. You're sort of, finding out kind of new information, raising questions from either old data or other interpretations, and then needing new evidence to try to continue to put that story and that picture together.
That's kind of the science behind that, is you guys are not in the field where you find things out in an immediate. It's the long haul. Mm-hmm. It takes you guys years to come to conclusions, because you have to wait for things that are hundreds and hundreds of millions of miles away to do something in order to get confirmation. And that's where it becomes so abstract, is, you think out there that light is immediate, electricity and light and all that stuff. You turn on your lights and they come on and the light goes on instantly, and you hit the button on your camera and the flash goes off instantly. But then you start thinking of actual distances. And I remember one time being kind of nerdy and couldn't sleep, so I figured out what it was in miles per hour for the speed of light, and it was 670 million miles an hour. And so if you think about it from that perspective, it's, what does it take light 8 minutes to get from the sun?
Mm-hmm. We are at, because light does have a finite speed, the speed of light, right? But it's not instantaneous, just like you said, even though things that are very nearby, right, it of course feels that way, that's instantaneous, right? We turn the light switch on in our room, but the light, even though it's kind of cloudy and drizzly here today, but the sunlight that might be coming into your car window or your office window, right, is left the surface of the sun 8 minutes ago. And that's our home star, our nearest star. If we just take the nearest jump out to the next nearest star outside of our own solar system, that's about 4 light years away, right? So the light that is finally reaching our telescopes or reaching our eyes left that star 4 years ago. And that's just the things that are, you know, right nearby. So when we go beyond our own galaxy, right, we start to talk about things that are, you know, millions, if not billions of light years away in terms of distance and how long it's taken the light to travel to reach our telescopes.
And when you're talking about those things, there's a distinct possibility that those things have either gone supernova or whatever their ending was a long time ago. It's just it takes that long to go through the infinite length of space. And it's that's where things like you can picture a planet crashing into another. You can even think about in sort of a weird way how it takes 8 minutes for light to get from the sun to here. But when you start thinking about how light took 4 years and it still is the fastest thing that we know out there. And it's,
right.
You know, it's that's why when people start talking about like I'm a firm believer, just to get on a weird tangent, I'm a firm believer that there has to be life out there just based on the numbers. I don't know if they're visiting us.
Yeah.
Based
yeah.
on the fact
I would
that,
agree with that, both of those
yeah,
statements.
It's the amount of energy and know-how that you would have to get in order to get here, even just 4 light years away. Maybe we don't understand that yet. Maybe we as a society and as a species have not quite gotten to that kind of science yet. We are bending space-time and making wormholes, and I'm not going to get into the whole nerdy Star Trek Star Wars sort of thing when warp speed and all that kind of thing. But it's a you think about something just the amount of generations it would take. The granted, traveling at light speed, time is different for you, and that's once again a whole other nerdy tangent
to
go
yeah.
on. But there are just you think about the energy it would take to travel that fast for that long and just under those circumstances. And there's a distinct possibility that the weird UFOs that people are seeing in the sky are not, in fact, aliens. While I firmly
right.
believe that there are aliens out there and that there is some form of intelligent life, the numbers dictate there must be. But stopping by and saying hi or doing weird things to a cow, I'm not sure that that's happening.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And yeah, just, you know, looking around our own home planet Earth, right, and just where life can thrive and can grow is just, you know, amazing, right? It can live and thrive and develop in, you know, the darkest, deepest bottom parts of the ocean, right, where there's basically no sunlight. You know, the hottest, the coldest places that we can imagine. So, and then, yeah, you can ask the question of intelligent life and, it, you know, evolution and nature seems to eventually get there, right? But in how we, what do we define, you know, we can argue there's definitely many, many species of intelligent life on our home planet, right? But abilities to communicate or to travel, in space is so big and so vast, right? It's very much searching for a needle in a haystack.
Just to put it into like a cost thing, I one time heard, and this was years ago, so the cost is probably way more now, that for NASA to launch a pound into space, it cost $10,000. And so you have to start with the vehicle itself, which weighs hundreds of tons, and then go from there. So, you know, the energy it would take in order to propel something that fast for that long, I mean, I would love it to exist. I would love for to look up in the sky and see a big alien spaceship, and hopefully they're coming in peace. But that story is a little too abstract.
Right.
But it is
yeah.
fun to talk about, and these things are fun to talk about with someone who actually knows what they're talking about, not just my dopey radio buddies in the middle of the night when we can't sleep. So this has been really fun for me to be able to talk to someone who knows the actual science behind so much. And I think it's fun the fact that there is an event that is happening literally in our backyard. There is an event that is happening, and that's got to be so much fun for you and your the McDonald Observatory, because you don't have to move. It is in your backyard. You don't have to hop on a plane and go somewhere. You don't have to hike up a mountain or anything like that to get to an observatory. You get to do this at home and in your own work circumstances. This is like a home court advantage to a certain degree.
Yeah, definitely. And as long as the weather cooperates, which you never know in Central Texas in April, but we'll all be keeping our fingers crossed. So yeah, it really is kind of to be on a spot in on Earth where, you know, actual total solar eclipse is happening, is rare, definitely can be kind of a once in a lifetime event, because even though On average, we probably have a total solar eclipse somewhere on Earth every 1 to 18, every like 12 months to 18 months. Again, the chance of it happening at your exact location is pretty rare. Yeah, it's really exciting. I hope if you are anywhere in the path of totality, you are definitely getting outside and we'll be checking it out, and most of Austin will be able to experience that. If you're slightly outside the path of totality, if you're at like 99%, it's 1,000% worth it to make sure you can get somewhere, even if it's just traveling, a few extra miles, to get closer to the path of totality and to be in a spot for totality.
And for people, let's just say, you live in dead center of the city of Austin, where would that be for us? Because we're City of Austin, which is obviously the main audience for these four radio stations that the show is on. But it goes out, obviously the radio stations go out a little bit further, and we are not in the City of Austin. We are not exactly, we are just a couple of degrees off the totality, correct?
Yeah, so most of Austin will experience some amount of totality. We're not right on the center line of totality, so we won't have like the longest possible eclipse time. But if you're kind of in the western kind of half of the city, you definitely will have totality, even like very central Austin. I'm sitting here right in my office here on the UT campus. UT will be in totality and experience totality. So if you're just kind of in the slightly on the eastern half side of town, places like Del Rio, I think you're just off of the totality line. So to get just travel in a little bit westward, and you should be able to get to a spot where there's totality. And again, that's basically where the essentially the darkest part of the shadow of the moon is casting will be, landing on our location here on the Earth, on the surface. And so the entire face of the sun will be fully eclipsed for those couple minutes of totality.
Joining me to talk about the moon, the sun, the stars, and our funny little blue dot marble planet is Keeley Finkelstein, who is an associate professor at the Department of Astronomy at the College of Natural Sciences at the University of Texas. She also works for the McDonald Observatory. If you would like more information, go to mcdonaldobservatory.org. The eclipse is happening on Monday. It'll happen in the noon hour to about 3 o'clock. If you would like to be able to find out the best spot to go, I would imagine that there is more information also at mcdonaldobservatory.org. And the eclipse it happens over a couple of hours. Obviously, there is the in the middle of it is the what is it called? Maximum totality. And okay, for the record, if Cosmic Coincidence is a jam band, Maximum Totality is a heavy metal band. It starts at around 12:18 and it goes until around 2:58, with Maximum Totality at around 1:37. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. So again, here kind of right in central Austin, you should get close to, again, depending exactly where you are, somewhere from maybe 1 minute to two and a half minutes of totality. And the totality time really is that short period where the moon has completely gone and blocked in front of the face of the sun, respective to your location. But yeah, the partial eclipse. So kind of basically, can kind of think of the moon sort of slowly marching across the face of the sun. That partial eclipse will begin, a little after 12 p.m. and we'll kind of go all the way almost to 3 p.m. So we'll kind of march across, be perfectly everything lined up, and have the totality, and then it will slowly start marching back off, and we'll have the kind of again partial eclipse all the way up till about close to 3 p.m.
And now here's the part of the show where I tell you out there to not look at the sun during the eclipse. I think that should be something that is kind of a universal rule. Don't look at the sun. There are glasses available. Some places are giving them out free for promotional reasons. I'm sure you can buy some on Amazon. There's lots of hacks that you can find on the internet and on social media to be able to observe it without looking at the sun. It should seem obvious, but just because in today's day and age, you have to put a disclaimer on everything. Don't walk outside and stare at the sun.
Don't stare directly at the sun. Yeah, that's 100% true. And yeah, you can find eclipse viewers or eclipse glasses in lots of places. I've seen them in my local HEB, just kind of out there by the registers and stuff. So that's great. There are lots of places. So yeah, as long as you get, and they are certified, solar eclipse viewers glasses, there you're good to go. I will say, so again, only if you're at a spot where you have totality and only during that minute or two of totality, it is safe. You can take off your glasses to look at the sun when it's fully covered, and that's actually when you will see the corona of the sun. And if you have the eclipse glasses viewers on, you actually won't be able to see it. So during totality, but only during that time, and maybe wait until you're fully in totality, for by a few seconds, you can remove your glasses and look at it and see the corona of the sun. And that's the very hottest outer part. Of the basically the atmosphere of the sun. It's like tens of millions of degrees, much part hotter than what we call the chromosphere, the surface of the sun that we can kind of normally, that looks bright at visible wavelengths. But it's very, very thin. So normally it's just kind of outshine, out dominated by the regular, sun. So you don't, it can't be visible only during an eclipse time. So that's actually a really cool thing that most people normally would never get to see. You only can see it during the eclipse, the totality.
Joining me on Inside Austin from the McDonald Observatory is Kaylee Finkelstein. If you would like more information on the upcoming April 8th eclipse, go to mcdonaldobservatory.org. Once again, it's what is that cosmic coincidence of the moon being just the right size to cover the sun under just the right circumstances. In addition to that nice little dance that they do along with the Earth and the Earth does around the sun, and it's just one of those amazing things that to think that it wasn't that long ago that this scared people that they thought the gods were mad and maybe sacrificed a virgin into the volcano or something silly like that. It is such a testament to the human brain and how we have had this innate need to figure things out and know why. And it is amazing to think that, not that long ago, certainly in celestial history, what was half a second ago, we were afraid of these things happening. And it is amazing to think that we have come so far in so many different ways that we actually not only understand an eclipse, but we understand the sun and how we got the moon and what's happening on planets that are far beyond our ability to ever see. And I think it's amazing how you people, the people who do what you do for a living are able to find like planets that are far off in other galaxies. Is you look for wobbling light and all these innovative and smart ways to be able to troubleshoot the fact that you can't actually see it. And it just goes to show you the ingenuity and the amazing things the brain will do when given a challenge and someone has the tenacity to follow that through.
Yeah, no, that's 100% correct. And kind of actually one of the things I think, slightly off topic, but you mentioned searching for planets and finding planets around other stars. We definitely do that with that wobble effect that you mentioned. That's kind of one of the most the best ways and where we've found. But we also basically there's a couple other ways we can try to find planets, and it's in its own way kind of related to eclipses, but it's actually when planets kind of if they're lined up also to our kind of line of sight and they're moving in front of their home star, and we're not able to for most cases image them directly, but they basically are kind of providing like a mini little eclipse, or they're like blocking a tiny bit of that star's light, and we can measure that small change in that star's light or brightness and say and then find that kind of repeated pattern when every time that planet goes in front of the star, it causes a kind of again, a mini little eclipse, or we call a transit, and we're detecting that small change in the star's brightness because the planet's blocking a little bit of that light.
All right, so take that a step further and explain to everybody what redshift is and why you can figure out how far away it is.
So again, most of the ways that we're finding these planets around other stars is kind of through interactions that the planet has with the star and monitoring and looking for changes from coming from the star itself. So it's either changes in that star's light, just like monitoring it over time. And so we see small like drops or little dips in that star's brightness over time that's repeated. Or that thing that you mentioned, the wobble, and that's where kind of this idea of what we call redshift and blueshift. So the star is not actually sitting still, and neither is our own sun, right? Anytime you have two objects that have mass, they are there. There's a gravitational attraction, a gravitational force between both objects, and they're kind of causing each other to sort of do these dances or circles around each other. Of course, the star, like our own sun, being the more, massive, very, very much more massive thing. It doesn't move nearly as much, but it basically wobbles. It kind of moves back and forth due to the force of gravity every time that, as the planet is circling around it. It's also kind of circling around doing this small little wobble and dance. And that's a motion, but because the star is continually sending out light, that light, just like we call the Doppler effect, right? How, we measure, police use like Doppler radar guns to track your speed, to measure kind of changes in your speed as you're approaching or moving away from the source. We do that with the light coming from these stars. So if the star happens to sort of be shifting away from us in its little circle, little wobble around its axis, its light will be kind of stretched out, or we call redshifted. And then when the star starts to move towards us, the light gets shifted to shorter wavelengths, or to like what we call blue shift, to bluer colors. And we can just measure that change and that shift. And that's how we know that the star is wobbling around, and we can estimate and tell, say, oh, there has to be this mass, this size planet orbiting around it, causing that wobble or that shift in its light.
Well, doesn't it also help you know how far away the star is too?
Yeah. So we can measure it both, it tells us, we can estimate basically the amount of the shift, tells us kind of the relationship of the mass between the two objects. And then how it's repeated tells us kind of the period between the two things. And then we can kind of use other things. We can use that for even more distant things to tell how far away, like we call it, it's called cosmic redshift or and stuff. Yeah. So we can kind of use that redshift, blue shift in a number of different ways to tell us information.
Isn't that amazing out there? Just, I find this stuff absolutely fascinating in so many ways. Like the fact that people are able to figure out not just the fact that a planet exists in an entirely different neighborhood of the galaxy that we are in, but they're able to figure out the size, the distance from the star, and the distance from us. And this is all on things that they can't see, and what they can see through a telescope, there's a distinct possibility that that light is no longer shining. It certainly isn't where they're looking anymore, but it's such a fascinating thing to think about. I know a lot of people out there, when they think about the stars and the celestial bodies, and they're staring out into space, particularly when you get the chance to be around no light pollution and you're looking up at the actual Milky Way and that bowl of stars around you everywhere you look, a lot of people kind of get this feeling of smallness and insignificantness, and I have the opposite. I stand there and I think to myself just how cool it is to be a part of something so big, so grand, so happenstance at the same time. It is such an amazing thing to be, kind of like the cliche you hear about being, part of the universe experiencing itself. There's some truth to that. That's amazing to be able to be a thinking body, human, functioning person, whatever you want to call it, in this on this planet, in this solar system, in this galaxy, where I can think about these things. I can think about where my sun came from. I can think about where the moon and the stars and the implications they have on my life. It is such an amazing thing to be able to be the universe experiencing itself, and then having a conversation with another part of the universe who's also experiencing itself. Like, these are some fascinating and some really cool things to think about. And it's an amazing conversation to have on my level, because, I'm just an idiot who works at a radio station who can talk for a living. And I can only imagine how much fun it must be to do what you do for a living, because we're sitting here on Zoom and she has been smiling the entire time. So I can tell that she enjoys what she does, and to think about these things for a living, that's a great way to pull a paycheck.
Yeah, no, it is really fun. I mean, I've always had that interest in space and astronomy as a young kid. And so, yeah, definitely feel lucky and privileged to still get to do this for a living as an adult. But I mean, I get my joy and my passion from, getting to share this with others, and whether it's my students in my class, and even if they're just, taking it because they need their science credit, but hopefully there's some, some aspect of it, whether it's just they know a little bit more now, they can tell their friends, when they hopefully go out and watch the eclipse, right? They know a little bit more about, how the sun, earth, and moon interact, or, share that with their friends and family. Or also sharing this with just other people kind of around our city, around our state, whether it's, teachers in K-12 classrooms, or again, other folks. So I love what I get to do, and it is a real privilege. So
And I do want to highlight on the teaching aspect of things, because that is ultimately your sort of 9-to-5 real job. It's just you get to talk about the eclipse because it's happening in your backyard.
yeah.
But come 2 weeks from now, you're going to go back to your normal, I would imagine, your normal curriculum and your normal classwork and stuff like that. And so being somebody who is imparting that knowledge to the next group of people who are interested, even if they are just taking a science credit to check off the list, they're still going to walk away with some pretty cool information. They're going to see the universe and the stars in a different way. But to be able to go after those people who are going to end up just like you and doing this for a living and staring out into space for a job, is that's got to be kind of a nice thing to pass down. I don't even know the right word for it. It's almost like it's sort of like a Jedi thing where, you guys are going to be thinking about things in a bigger way for humanity's understanding and for humanity's sake. And so to find that next generation and to be able to impart your knowledge and watch them grow and watch them succeed in the same field that you work in, that's got to be one of the better feelings. Maybe a little bit better than having an eclipse in your backyard, because you get to do it year in and year out. And that is literally the bigger mark you get to leave on the world. But I would imagine that that's got to be probably the most fun thing in your job, is watching the smile on other people's faces as you watch their knowledge grow and their love for what they do grow.
Yeah, it is. It is really exciting. And, hopefully people, if they're taking astronomy, whether they're taking it for their, major, and that's what they want to do, and this is the career they see for themselves. Right. And I think astronomy can, and like all sciences, all fields, aspirationally, it should be accessible to everyone that wants to partake. But I kind of see astronomy as a way, right? Like, there are expensive aspects of it, whether it's, the big telescopes that we want to be able to build and fund and whatnot. But, if you have that drive and that interest and that inspiration, and you want to study this, right? Like, there really shouldn't be any barriers to keeping people out of this field. It really is should be accessible and open to everyone. And whether, or if it's just kind of a passing interest, right? That's amazing, and that's great too, right? Like, just asking those kind of big questions, and even if it's just, having people think about how we go about the scientific process, and why we're, interested. That's why we're asking these big questions, why we keep pushing this, right? It's part of how, we, as again, humanity, both keep growing and kind of pushing the boundaries in terms of, technology and new discoveries and things along those lines. So helping the next generation of students be able to do that, and I'm sure make bigger leaps and bigger bounds than those of us that are currently, we're working on whatever problems we're working on today.
That's one of the cool things about that being a teacher is that, you might be the person who taught the guy who did end up finding life on another planet, or the physics professor who the guy cracked why gravity works or something like that. And it's I would imagine that that has got to be an amazing feeling also, knowing that you were part of that process in that discovery, because you were the person who helped mold the person who discovered it. And these things aren't singular. They are, as a rule, not just that you have a team right now, but you're kind of on the shoulders of the people who stood underneath and did some more work and had to do math without computers and all that sort of stuff, and slide rules. And so it's amazing to think the journey that the field has taken, but also the information that has come to it, to where we are here talking about, we know the exact minute, because these guys can do some amazing math, that the totality of the eclipse is going to be above us, and we know exactly where to be. And these things do have an actual impact on our everyday life. And you start thinking about GPS satellites and the things that are on the actual more practical side of things
Right.
that once again astronomy has had a hand in. And it is fascinating. The people who get to stare up into the stars are also some of the smartest people. And having that imagination plus the actual science smarts, book smarts, is a pretty fun combination to have a conversation with on my little radio show here. And so I very much appreciate your time. I very much appreciate your information, but I also I appreciate what you do for a living. And if anyone would like any more information on what they do, go to the McDonaldObservatory.org. The eclipse will be happening on the 8th Monday. It'll be, it's the first since 2017. If you are anywhere near Central Austin, as she said, sort of what Central Western Austin is kind of the place to be.
Yeah, definitely correct. Yep.
So around from 1218 to, from let's just say 1215 to 3 o'clock. Go ahead and give it some round numbers so you can remember. 1215 to around 3 o'clock is the entire event. And a little bit after 1:30, about 1:37, will be the maximum totality. And we are about to witness something that not that long ago scared humanity. And it's because of our amazing curiosity that now we understand it. And I appreciate you hanging out with us for a half hour listening to this conversation. But I also very much appreciate Keely Finkelstein's information. She is an associate professor at the Department of Astronomy for the College of Natural Sciences for the University of Texas. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records. This is a national contest.